This is the Voice of Freedom.
Believe what you have been seeing.
All the times, they are changing.
Ladies and gentlemen, the corporate United States has declared war upon the citizens.
Burn that flag in protest. Now show me that.
Any general who ventures upon a battlefield without understanding the enemy is doomed to defeat. Because I'm in a place of great knowledge about who's winning and who's losing this war. I've learned some things, and I think these things need to be passed on to you.
It's a spirit that really, rather than a style.
No. We have to see ourselves as the authors of a new justice. And wherever we find injustice and tyranny, we must stamp it. We must kill it.
So, your answer to this so-called sneaky terrorism is to provoke violence.
I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now, and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out, and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Anybody got any questions? Just kidding. Thank you. Fuck you. Bye. Jam's fucking out, baby!
What's up, Hep Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? It's your host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See here on another Friday morning in America. We gotta stop meeting like this. I said I was taking the Wednesday off because I did 3 episodes in 4 days, and here we are, and it's Wednesday, and I'm yelling into a microphone again. But it's a thing that feels necessary because things keep happening that make me feel like we need to talk about them. So here we are. If you've paid any attention to the news lately, the Turner Diaries are happening outside, which is kind of alarming, not unexpected by any stretch of the imagination if you've had eyes for like the past 25 years, but still disconcerting the rise in transphobic and homophobic violence, threats of violence, domestic terrorism, etc., has boggled my mind, I guess, in a way. And it's, like I said, it's not unexpected. This is a gradual, this is a progression of all of the things that we've been talking about on the show, that have taken place in this country since roughly like 1900, really. I mean, let's be fucking real. 1776 and earlier, if we're being honest. But in terms of the fascist creep and the establishment of like the ideals that started out as fringe and then just became what conservatives are in this country, all of that stuff. If you followed any of that, none of this is entirely surprising, but it's all still sort of gonzo to just keep hearing reports about, like, you know, 18-wheelers full of food being hijacked and people stealing cows and attacks being made on the power grid, and everybody's just supposed to, like, go to work and watch Wheel of Fortune, and it just seems very, very hard for me to grasp. I don't know if it's whatever numerous things are wrong with my brain that make it impossible for me to contextualize that in a way that makes sense, but I feel like I spend a lot of my time walking around looking at people and thinking, why isn't everybody screaming? And I still don't know why, because every day a new thing happens where I think this has got to be it, right? Like, we should call it. This whole democracy and civility thing clearly hasn't been working for like 150 years. Maybe we should I don't know, try something else, line some people up and do some things, whatever. But no, just, you know, go to CVS, it'll be fine. And that's remarkable to me, but such is life as an American, I guess. So today I struggled with how to even classify what we're talking about. It's sort of one of the things that we've come to be known for here on the show, I think, where it's not so much that there is a specific subject as we're going to talk about several things surrounding a topic, I guess, with a broader focus on, like, the rise in transphobia, trans violence, homophobia, etc., in the last, say, 10 years, but really we're going to go back way further than that. And we're going to talk about culture war, what culture wars are. We're going to talk a little bit about the Proud Boys, but not super in-depth, because they, like so many other things that have come up on episodes recently, are going to have their own episode in the future. And we're going to talk about how, like, the Turner Diaries are happening, like I said, which just keeps fucking with my fucking head, if I'm being completely honest with all of you. But, you know, I guess you live, you learn, you get loves, and you roll a joint. I don't know. But we're gonna have a chat about some stuff, and maybe by the time I'm done yelling, I'll have figured some things out. We'll see. I apologize that I locked you here in this closet with me while I work through whatever this is about to be, but here we fucking go. I think it's important to observe how what started out as a culture war that was fueled by media and left unchecked resulted in acts of domestic terrorism, because it illustrates one of the uses or tools of mass hysteria, outrage, and culture war, which is the demonization and attack on a marginalized demographic. We discussed mass hysteria in the past on the Satanic Panic episode of the show, and I think a little bit during spooky season. But today, I really wanted to talk a little bit about culture wars, just for starters. A culture war is defined as a conflict between social groups and the struggle for dominance of their values, beliefs, and practices. The term commonly refers to topics on which there is general societal disagreement and polarization in social values. In contemporary parlance, a culture war is a social phenomenon in which multiple social groups holding distinct values and ideologies attempt to steer public policy in opposition to each other. Culture wars tend to develop around what are called wedge issues, which are issues that split demographical opinions. These wedge issues comprise what are known as political cleavage, which are social and cultural lines which divide citizens within a society into groups with differing political interests, resulting in political conflict amongst these groups. Cleavage theory argues that political cleavages predominantly determine a country's party system, as well as the individual voting behavior of citizens, dividing them into voting blocks. Persistent examples of this would be church and state, owner and worker, and land and industry. The idea of culture war as a means of influencing political cleavage to drive national opinion originated where the fuck else? In Germany, with Rudolf Virchow's Kulturkampf in the 1870s. We discussed the Kulturkampf a bit last season in our discussion about the separation of church and state, which I think happened on the episode about education, but you'll have to fact check me on that one. The Kulturkampf, though, was a struggle between Otto von Bismarck and German religious groups for control of German society. American politics are driven, especially nowadays, almost exclusively by culture wars. Really beginning in the 1980s and ramping up significantly in the 21st century, culture wars over issues like abortion, drugs, welfare, gun rights, and censorship fairly define most Americans' political identities, which have, in many cases over the years, come to just be most Americans' identities. Trans rights aren't necessarily a new issue specifically. For example, the Institute for Sexual Wissenschaft in Tiergarten, Berlin, was a private research institute on what's called sexology that opened in 1919. The institute conducted academic studies in the fields of, among other things, gender identity, sexual orientation, transgender and intersex subjects, and the institute also offered services to the public such as treatment for alcoholism, contraceptive treatment, gynecological exams, marriage counseling, sex therapy, treatment for venereal disease, as well as educational opportunities for health professionals and the general public. Sounds like the dopest thing ever, which is probably why someone destroyed it. The Nazi book burnings that were conducted by the German Student Union in the 30s specifically targeted sexology literature, as well as any books with Jewish, communist, socialist, anarchist, and pacifist messages in their authorship. As such, most of the Institute's records and archives were targeted and destroyed, and ultimately the Institute itself and all of its libraries were burned down as part of Nazi censorship efforts. The Institute's founder, Magnus Hirschfeld, was a regular target of Nazi rhetoric beginning in the 1920s. Well, okay, not just the Nazis, actually, the entire German right wing in general, who found common cause with the Nazis in their general hatred for the work that the Institute was doing. Hirschfeld was attacked and beaten multiple times, shot at, threatened, and the Nazi purge on homosexuality preceding the Night of the Long Knives and the murder of Ernst Röhm, we're going to talk about it later this season, completely outlawed gay clubs, banned gay groups, outlawed sex publications, and caused a mass exodus in the late 20s and early 30s. On May 6th, 1933, the German Student Union, accompanied by a fucking brass band, raided the Institute. The leader of the students led the mob in singing Horst Wessel Lied, which was Hitler's favorite song. It's also, I think, illegal in Germany now, as the building was sacked and destroyed. And Dora Richter, the first person known to have undergone complete gender reassignment surgery, was murdered. Between 12,000 and 20,000 books and journals were looted and burned by the brown shirts, including artistic works, rare medical and anthropological documents, charts concerning cases of intersexuality, and some information that would be lost completely until the Kinsey Institute resumed the study of sexology in 1947. It just calls to mind the burning of the Library of Alexandria, doesn't it? Because throughout history, these cats who seek world domination or some form of societal control, for whatever reason, part of that really needs to involve the destruction of any information of any kind. And that sucks for two reasons. The first of them is that we now lose all of this vital information and all of this stuff that a lot of people put a lot of work into, and now people have the ability to say that this is a new phenomenon because we didn't know about trans people before the 1980s or whatever the fuck. Well, yeah, because all the records that they had from the 19th century were burned down by fascists very, very intentionally. And the other part of it is that the argument that the first thing that someone does in the suppression of a populace is destroy their records and suppress their speech is used in bad faith by the people who want to burn your records and destroy your speech. So it serves the dual purpose of providing a straw man for neo-fascists that you argue with in public forums, and also the actual suppression of actually marginalized people, unlike the white men who make millions and millions of dollars to tell you that no one will let them talk. Following the sacking of the Institute, newspapers decried the Institute's, quote, un-German spirit as contraception and homosexuality were viewed as threats to the German birth rate. Address lists were seized in the raid, and they were then used to facilitate gay purges following the Night of the Long Knives, and it's estimated that 100,000 gay men, just the men, were arrested and interned. We don't actually have records for the women or the trans people, we just know how many gay men, because that was the only group in this already marginalized group that they felt it was necessary to keep track of. One of the focuses of Nazi scientific research in concentration camps was finding a gay cure. So, just conversion therapy and the suppression of gay rights and the doxing of gay people so that they can be an attack by the general. Is everyone else as tired of how, oh my God, this has already happened, everything is these days? Or is it just me? Are all of you sick of hearing about, oh, this happened, and by the way, it also happened 75 fucking years ago, and no one told you about it, so you didn't know it happened, so now it's happening again, and everyone thinks that this is the first time that it's fucking happening. And in actuality, no, none of this is new. All the people who are trying to destroy society now read books written by the people who tried to destroy society 100 fucking years ago, because no one thought it would be a bad idea to let all of those assholes publish books, and then keep them for sale on the internet for like 50 fucking years. Because what's the worst that could happen, right? Free speech. Everybody should be allowed to say whatever the fuck they want, because that'll never backfire. And saying whatever you want should absolutely encompass, by the way, here's an instruction manual on how to blow up a children's hospital. Let's just let that all happen. What the fuck? You know, I'm going to full disclosure this for you, because I love you all. But, you know, I spend a lot of time on this show talking about and reading about people from, like, the 19th century who were very, very skeptical about the effectiveness of democracy. And I frame that in such a way as, isn't this ridiculous? This asshole didn't think democracy was a good idea. And I got to be honest with you, I don't think democracy is a good idea. There's the ability to influence people after giving them like 200 years of intentionally bad education that doesn't involve the ability to critically assess anything the fuck ever, and then taking people with billions and billions and billions of dollars and allowing them to intentionally generate propaganda to influence public opinion, and then create news networks to put that propaganda on television while you're eating dinner, and then you walk around and you think, why does everyone think all of this observably false, crazy bullshit that we disproved 100 years ago? and we know why, and what the fuck do you do about it? But understanding that the general public has been duped into thinking nonsense at a level that should be considered oversaturation at this point, should all of these people have a say in how the country is run? And I feel like the answer is no. I mean, all right, you can say that that's probably taking things too far in the wrong direction, but I'm sorry, there's a lot of people who think that secret shape-shifting reptiles from the sunken city of Atlantis secretly run the government, and they and the Jews want to make everybody gay to overthrow the country, and those people shouldn't be allowed to vote. I'm sorry. You know, I went to a gas station yesterday, and I parked next to a lifted pickup truck, which was probably like a $50,000 or $60,000 truck, which is more than most people make in a year, and that in and of itself should be an indictment on the effectiveness of capitalism, but that's another story for another day. And this truck had a 3%er emblem, the three Roman numerals that let you know that this asshole thinks he's in a militia, on the back of his pickup truck, and directly under that was Bigfoot holding a rifle. So the two things you can assess about this man who spent your annual income on a pickup truck that he has probably never put anything in the bed of ever, because working class is an affectation that everybody uses in this country. But again, that's another conversation for another day. Let me get back to the fucking point. So the two things you can assess from this asshole with a $60,000 pickup truck is that he believes in Bigfoot and his inalienable right to own firearms. And anyone who prioritizes life in that way shouldn't get to decide what goes in the water, is all I'm saying. Okay. Let me get back to the script. So we've talked about Germany, but the United States, of course, had its own gay purge in the Lavender Scare, which we've talked about a bit back in the COINTELPRO episode. The Lavender Scare was a subset of McCarthy's war on communism that really wiped homosexuals from the American workforce. Secret communist infiltrator Dwight Eisenhower signed Executive Order 10450 on April 27th, 1953. It was made effective exactly 1 month later. 10450 charged the heads of federal agencies and the Civil Service Commission, with the support of the FBI, of course, with investigating federal employees to determine whether they posed a risk to national security. 10450 also expanded the definitions and conditions used to define risk of national security. And it effectively barred homosexuals from government employment, adding sexual orientation to the acceptable list of reasons for job termination. This remained effective until 1977, when the State Department lifted the ban on gay employment, and the order wasn't rescinded until 1995, and it wasn't repealed until 2017. That was actually the last act of the Obama administration. Opposition to gay rights was one of the tent poles of the old right, and of course it took the Reagan administration longer to address the AIDS epidemic than DC Comics. Gay marriage was an extremely hot-button culture war, and most states had anti-sodomy laws on the books until the 21st century. Massachusetts was the first state to recognize same-sex marriage in the U.S. in 2004, and by 2015, it was recognized in all 50 states based on the ruling of Loving v. Virginia in 1967, which established marriage as a fundamental right guaranteed by the Due Process Clause and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. That thing that the Supreme Court's kind of trying to dismantle right now. Anyway, gay rights issues kind of remain on an American culture war. And in the last 10 years, transphobia has really become a driving force in America's cultural forever war. We really saw the beginning of this with the attempted implementation of what are called bathroom bills. Bathroom bills is sort of a collective colloquialism used to describe legislation or statutes that deny access to public restrooms based on gender identity. Bathroom bills affect access to sex-segregated public facilities for an individual based on a determination of their sex as defined in some specific way, such as their sex as assigned at birth, their sex as listed on their birth certificate, or the sex that corresponds to their gender identity. Proponents of bathroom bills argue that such legislation is necessary to maintain privacy and prevent things like voyeurism, assault, molestation, and rape. Now, to date, there are no cases of transgender people attacking cisgendered people in public restrooms at all, and the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, and the American Academy of Pediatrics all oppose the implementation of bathroom bills. But the usefulness of transphobia in the development of political cleavage is undeniable. Conservative media, which is the dominant media in the United States, presents coverage of the issues as being more popular than they actually are. Polls suggest that the American public is fairly 50-50 on trans rights. A survey by the Public Religion Research Institute found that 47% of Americans supported bathroom bills, as well as the restriction of locker rooms, bathrooms, and changing areas that trans people are permitted to use in schools and public spaces. That was in 2017, which was actually a 12% increase from 2016. The majority of these bathroom bills did fail, of course, except for one. The Public Facilities Privacy and Security Act of North Carolina. The fact that it's in North Carolina will be relevant later. Also known as House Bill 2, the act was passed in March of 2016 and signed into law by Governor Pat McCrory. The bill amended state law to preempt any anti-discrimination ordinances passed by local communities and compelled schools and state and local government facilities containing single-gender washrooms to only allow people of the corresponding sex as listed on their birth certificate. Critics of the legislation, which was repealed the following year, argued that despite being called common sense legislation, there is no effective way to implement or enforce it. But that isn't really the point. Bathroom bills were a reaction. In 2013, the Colorado Civil Rights Division ruled in favor of 6-year-old transgender student Coy Mathis's use of the girls' restroom at her elementary school. This was the first ruling of its kind in the United States, and really the first high-profile trans rights case to garner mass media attention. And as such, in order to respond to the feeling that things were changing in a way that they couldn't control, a lot of Americans lost their goddamn minds. And I can, to an extent, I can understand these people and their visceral emotional reaction to not understanding what it means to be trans, what intersexuality is, why suddenly there are new terms you have to know, and why all of this seems like someone is trying to force them to do a thing they don't want to do. You know, if I can divert from an episode where I've already made several diversions, whenever the George Floyd protests were happening a couple of years ago, my partner at the time and I were discussing why her parents had difficulty understanding the concept of police brutality and contextualizing the idea that the police are not, in fact, your friends and don't actually solve crime. That a lot of what most people's idea of what the cops are is entirely a misconception created by propaganda made by the government. And the explanation that I gave for that, I think, is applicable here, too. And it's that changing the way you think, evolving as a person, maintaining an understanding of the ever-evolving social consciousness, which grows to include new groups of recognized marginalized people, not necessarily groups that weren't here before. Not to suggest that trans people are a new phenomenon. They absolutely are not. One of the issues is that up until like the 1980s or 1990s, most studies grouped trans as a part of homosexuality. It was all just one big thing. So even the recognition that, no, this is a separate subgroup within a larger group that you also don't know enough about, because most of the studies done up until recently were done in bad faith for the purposes of like eugenics and shitty science. But keeping up with a social consciousness that never stops moving is work. And especially if you are a white, cis, heterosexual person, particularly if you're a man, there is absolutely nothing ever that forces you to do any of that. It is work that you choose to do that, quite frankly, because of the way social structure works, you don't even have to do well or correctly to feel like, and in many cases, be entitled to being congratulated just for half-assed trying at something that you never do right. So it's very, very easy to never understand how pronouns work, to not understand that there's more than two types of sexuality, that there's more than two gender identities or anything like that, because you, generally speaking, unless you are directly affected, a member of one of these groups, and not directly part of or are part of what is the social ruling class, you never have to reckon with any of that shit if you don't want to. So the idea that lots of people who never have to be exposed to something will preemptively do the work that does not affect them, that in many cases they don't give a shit about, is rather presumptive on our part. Like, the average white person doesn't need to rethink racial social structure. It's never going to matter to them. And if they even consider it, they've done more work than will ever be required of them in that field. So this understanding that the ruling class is going to figure out how the other half lives is a high expectation, really, for those of us who are not of the ruling class in many ways. And that is why I think, in so many cases, the average person's understanding of gender and sexual identity is what it is, considering the science has been proven out and been available for quite some time that disproves 99% of the arguments that you hear people having about this stuff. But anyway, let me get back to the thing. In 2016, the Department of Justice and the Department of Education released a joint guidance on the application of Title IX protections to transgender students. Trans rights and the surrounding culture war have really been at the forefront of American political discourse ever since. The issue is much older than that, obviously. The 1993 rape and murder of Brandon Tina was the subject of national discussion, particularly after the release of the film Boys Don't Cry. And going back further than that, the 1969 Stonewall riots were led by Marsha P. Johnson, a drag queen and gay liberationist and AIDS activist. Stats are complicated because, like I said, for much of history, trans and homosexual have been lumped together interchangeably in collected data. But, for example, trans panic, or trans advance defense has been used as a justification for violence committed against trans people specifically. The trans panic defense attempts to argue that the perpetrator of an assault against a trans person acted in a state of violent temporary insanity due to unwanted sexual advances, perceived or otherwise. The legal framework for this dates back to 1859, and the concept of homosexual panic, of course, was coined in 1920 by Edward J. Kempf as, quote, a condition of panic due to the pressure of uncontrollable perverse sexual cravings, end quote. Kempf classified this as an acute pernicious dissociative disorder identified by a disruption in typical perception. The condition even appears in the DSM-1. Although in its original conception, gay panic was also said to be caused by one's own, quote, aroused homosexual cravings, end quote. The gay panic defense was banned in Massachusetts, and in 2018, Senator Ed Markey and Representative Joe Kennedy introduced legislation to ban it at a national level. That legislation died in committee. It's since been unsuccessfully reintroduced in 2019 and 2021. Apparently, you can't get enough senators behind the idea that it's absolute fucking nonsense to say that you beat and or murdered someone because they were trans and close to you. But, you know, voting works. Anyway, perception versus reality is interesting, generally speaking. In contrast to there being no reports of trans people attacking cis people in bathrooms, a poll that was taken by the Journal of Public Management and Social Policy in 2019 showed that 70% of transgender respondents had experienced some form of discrimination while attempting to use the restroom of their gender identity, including, quote, denial of access to facilities, verbal harassment, and physical assault, end quote. Including one instance in particular where California Republican congressional candidate Jasmina Saavedra, or Saavedra, whatever, filmed herself and a restaurant manager removing a trans woman from a bathroom facility amidst threat of using pepper spray and a stun gun. The same study found that 54% of respondents reported having some sort of physical problem due to trying to avoid using public toilets, such as dehydration, kidney infection, and urinary tract infections. And these culture wars result in heightened rates of, as demonstrated a second ago, normalized anti-trans violence. The HRC Foundation has tracked record high numbers of anti-trans violence every year since 2018. 44 fatalities were recorded in 2020, and the highest concentration of anti-trans violence, of course, is committed against Black and Brown victims. In 2021, 57 transgender and non-conforming people were recorded murdered. And because you don't ever hear about this shit on the news, I'm gonna read you their names now. Tiana Alexander was also, she was 28 years old. She was a Black trans woman. She was shot to death in Chicago on January 6th. On social media, friends of Tiana posted that she had good energy and had a beautiful light, with one saying, I loved everything about her. Samuel Edmund Damian Valentine was a trans man who was killed on January 9th in Puerto Rico. Samuel was looking forward to starting the new year, and on January 1st, he posted on his Facebook page, a new year to come, grateful for all the experiences who taught me how strong we really are, to life, to good and bad, and for all justice that is forth to come. Bianca Banks was a Black transgender woman who was shot to death in Atlanta, Georgia on January 17th. On Friday, January 29th, her friends and the Trans Housing Coalition held a vigil outside of her apartment for her remembrance. Her nickname was Muffin. Dominique Jackson was a black transgender woman who was shot to death in Jackson, Mississippi on January 25th. According to her Facebook, Dominique was the mother of the House of Red and the founder of the Lady Red Incorporated. Friends remembered her on social media saying that they were at a loss for words. 50 Bands was a 21-year-old black transgender woman who was shot to death in Baton Rouge, Louisiana on January 28th. Alexis Braxton was a 45-year-old black trans woman who was killed on February 4th in Miami. She was a hairstylist. China Carrillo was killed in the morning hours of February 18th, 2021 in New Wilmington, Pennsylvania. There's not a whole lot known about her. She didn't have a very active social media profile, but she was very young to be murdered just for being who she was. Siblings, Jeffrey Bright, who was 16, a 16-year-old trans boy, and Jasmine Kennedy, a 22-year-old non-binary person. Both of them were from Ambridge, Pennsylvania. They were both killed on February 22nd. Jeffrey was a student at Ambridge High School, and Jasmine worked at FedEx, according to their Facebook page. They were both active in PRISM, which is a nonprofit organization for the LGBTQ plus youth of Beaver County, Pennsylvania. Jenna Franks was a 34-year-old white transgender woman who was killed in Jacksonville, North Carolina in February. She was part of the Onslow County LGBTQ plus community center family. Diamond Kyrie Sanders was a 23-year-old black trans woman who was shot to death in Cincinnati, Ohio on March 3rd. Rayana Pardo was a 26-year-old Latina trans woman who was killed on March 17th in Los Angeles. Jada Peterson, a 29-year-old black trans woman who was killed on April 4th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dominique Lucius, a 26-year-old black transgender woman who was shot and killed on April 8th in Springfield, Mississippi. Remy Fennell, a black transgender woman in her 20s, was shot to death on April 15th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Tiara Banks, a 24-year-old black transgender woman, was killed in Chicago, Illinois on April 21st. Natalia Smoot, I apologize if I mispronounced that, was a 24-year-old black and Puerto Rican transgender woman who was killed on April 23rd in Milpitas, California. Iris Santos, a 22-year-old Latinx transgender woman, was killed in Houston, Texas on April 23rd. Tiffany Thomas, a 38-year-old black transgender woman, was killed on April 24th in Dallas, Texas. Carrie Washington, a 49-year-old black transgender woman, was killed on May 1st in Clearwater, Florida. Jahari Dialto, a 42-year-old transgender woman, was killed on May 2nd in Boston, Massachusetts. Whispering Wind Bear Spirit, a 41-year-old indigenous non-binary person, was shot in New York, Pennsylvania on May 3rd and died early on May 4th. Sophie Vasquez, a 36-year-old Latina transgender woman, was shot and killed in Georgia on May 4th. Danica Danny Henson, who also went by Prince Daniel, a 31-year-old black transgender woman, was shot and killed in Baltimore, Maryland. Serenity Hollis, a 24-year-old black transgender woman, was shot and killed in Albany, Georgia on May 8th. Oliver Ollie Taylor, a 17-year-old white trans boy, died on May 19th after being kidnapped and shot on May 12th in Gervais, Oregon. Thomas Harden, a 35-year-old black transgender woman, was killed on May 2nd in York, South Carolina. Poe Black, who also went by Oliver Jackson, was a 21-year-old transgender man who was killed in Nylon, California. He lived in Slab City. E.J. Boykin, who also went by Nova Watson, was killed in Lynchburg, Virginia on June 14th. Adolin Evans, a 24-year-old black transgender woman, was found dead in March in Port Arthur, Texas. Taya Ashton, a 20-year-old black trans woman, was killed in Sutland, Prince George's County, Maryland on July 17th. Shai Vanderpump, a 23-year-old black trans woman, was killed in Trenton, New Jersey on July 30th. Tierra Marie Lewis, a 36-year-old black transgender woman, was killed in Cleveland, Ohio on June 12th. Miss Coco, a 44-year-old trans woman of color, was killed in Dallas, Texas on August 7th. Pooh Johnson, a 25-year-old black trans woman, was killed in Shreveport, Louisiana on August 23rd. Desea Monet, a 32-year-old black transgender woman, was fatally shot in Chicago on September 6th. Breonna Hamilton was a 25-year-old black transgender woman who was fatally shot in Chicago, Illinois. Kier LaPree Cartier, a 21-year-old black transgender woman, was fatally shot in Arlington, Texas on September 30th. Mel Groves, a 25-year-old black trans man, was fatally shot on October 11th in Jackson, Mississippi. Royal Poetic Stars, a 26-year-old black trans woman, was fatally shot in Miami Gardens, Florida on October 2nd. Zoella Zoe Rose Martinez, a 20-year-old Latina trans woman, was fatally shot in Maple Valley, Washington. Joe Acker, a white 26-year-old transgender woman, was killed in Boise, Idaho on October 26th. Jesse Hart, a white 42-year-old transgender woman, was killed in Banks, Oregon. Her body was found on October 17th. Ricky Utamuro, a.k.a. True Starlet, was a 39-year-old Latina transgender woman who was fatally shot in Centralia, Washington on October 30th, or the morning of October 31st. They're not actually sure. Marquisha Lawrence, a 28-year-old black trans woman, was found dead after being fatally shot in South Carolina on November 4th. Jenny De Leon was a 25-year-old Latina transgender woman who was found dead in Tampa, Florida on November 2nd. Angela Nera, a 36-year-old black transgender woman, was found fatally shot in her home in Aliquippa, Pennsylvania on November 11th. Danielle Thompson, a 35-year-old black trans woman, was killed in Memphis, Tennessee on November 13th. Chris Blahar, a 65-year-old white transgender woman. There isn't a date listed here. Nikai David, a 33-year-old black trans woman, was shot dead in Oakland, California on December 4th. Keahone Stone, a 32-year-old black trans woman, was found dead on December 28th, 2021 in Indianapolis, Indiana. Zaniah Williams, a 21-year-old black trans woman, was found dead on December 20th, 2021 after a hit and run in Houston, Texas. Nikki Turrieta, a 31-year-old trans woman, was found dead after being shot in Albuquerque, New Mexico on December 31st. Ruby Dominguez, a Latina trans woman, was the victim of a hit-and-run car crash in Arlington, Texas on July 16th. Kiva Scatter, a 34-year-old black trans woman, was found fatally shot in Baton Rouge, Louisiana on October 15th. Martina Caldera was found fatally shot in Houston, Texas on December 6th, 2021. And Jerry Judd, a transgender woman, was killed in Bossier City, Louisiana in September. This is just for 2021, and I know people who aren't on this list. Neek Kraft was killed by somebody in 2021. They are not on that list. So that's not comprehensive. It's just what was reported. And I do want to thank the HRC Foundation for compiling that, though. And I think it's important to remember that these, in the course of a culture war, the people who are dead because of the rhetoric espoused by fascists and hate mongers aren't statistics. They are people who were alive, had lives, had families, had people who loved them, had people that they loved, and were more than just an identity that it can be used for a Fox News piece or an MSNBC news piece, but they are actual people. So I felt that it was important to read those names, to really highlight that those are and were actual human beings, not just the casualties of a culture war about transphobia. And if anybody wants to send that list to J.K. Rowling, you have my blessing. The state of California is currently reporting its highest surge in hate crimes since 9/11, with a 48% increase from 2020 to 2021 alone. And again, the Black LGBTQIA+ community constitutes the majority of the victims. Anti-Black hate crime increased by 12.5%. Anti-Asian hate crime increased by 177.5%. And while 2022 isn't over yet, the numbers continue to rise. The number of hate groups nationwide rose significantly after January 6th, with one group in particular constituting the lion's share of recruitment, but we'll get to them later. In an attempt to combat a rise in transphobia and anti-trans violence, in 2015, Michelle T organized the first Drag Queen Story Hour. The first events were held in San Francisco. The events are typically geared towards children aged 3 to 11 and held in public libraries. As of 2019, there were 35 U.S. chapters organizing events and 5 international chapters. Michelle T. was the executive director of the nonprofit Radar Productions, and the first Drag Queen Story Hour events were a collaborative effort between T., Julian Delgado LaPera, and Virgie Tovar. The first event was held at the Eureka Valley Harvey Milk Memorial Branch Library and featured drag queen Persia reading stories to children and giving them educational lessons about the library. The organization features many drag queens of color, and it changed its name to Drag Story Hour in October of this year in an attempt to expand and be more inclusive and reflect the diverse cast of storytellers that they have. The New York chapter pairs with the New York Public Library and the Brooklyn Public Library, and by 2020, the 35 chapters had expanded to more than 50. During the pandemic, they, for purposes of shelter in place, stopped doing in-person Drag Queen Story Hour, but many Drag Queen Story Hour chapters offered online storytime live streams. Many of the DSH events include reading both classic children's stories and works featuring LGBT plus characters and issues like This Day in June, as well as Sewing the Rainbow, which is about Gilbert Baker, the creator of the rainbow flag, 10,000 Dresses, and Red, which is a story about a crayon who has a crisis of identity when it's given the wrong label. Disruption of these events, as you can imagine, has become a common popular right-wing tactic. Doxing, as well as acts of violence against performers at the events, has been the center of right-wing activism for the last few years, and is a rallying point for groups like the Groypers, the American Identity Movement, and the Proud Boys. The idea of teaching or normalizing trans identity has been met with legislative backlash as well. Let's talk about the Don't Say Gay bill. It's actually called the Parental Rights and Education Act. It is a Florida state law that was introduced and passed this year that outlines new statutes for public education, which prohibits classroom instruction on sexual orientation or gender identity in kindergarten through grade 3, or in a manner that is not age-appropriate or developmentally appropriate for students in accordance with state standards in public schools. Whatever the fuck that means, which is kind of the point. The act similarly prohibits schools from restricting parental access to students' education and health records. It was signed by Ron DeSantis, who just overtook Donald Trump in polls as far as popularity. He went from trailing Trump in double digits to leading him by 5 points this morning. Apparently, the fact that Trump thinks you should get a vaccine was a breaking point for enough people. Oh, and he had dinner with a Nazi. I forgot about that part. Anyway, It became effective on July 1st of this year. Supporters of the bill frame it as an anti-grooming bill, which is a dog whistle that's existed on the right wing for like a fucking century or more now, that seeks to conflate queerness and pedophilia. In many ways, the reaction to and legislation against critical race theory, which was another misguided culture war, you might remember it from like 2,000 years ago, paved the way for legislation targeting what conservatives broadly deem to be identity politics. The bill gives parents a path to sue school districts over curriculum deemed age inappropriate for students, and it bans lessons on orientation outright until the fourth grade, and makes it subjective based on what parents deem age appropriate beyond that, which is a pretty wide umbrella that, based on the overall white Christian nationalist population of your state, could mean that you're not learning about fucking until after you graduate from college, and you sure as hell won't learn anything about safe sex. And you know what? Am I gonna do it? Yeah, I am. I'm gonna do it again. Sorry. So It's always been, as a person who grew up around a lot of fundamentalist Christians who harbor a lot of these beliefs and were particularly homophobic, which is a funny way of saying a lot of them were probably closet cases. But anyway, it's always been interesting to me, both in my personal interactions with these people and studying things like racial science, eugenics, and things like that, that a lot of these people frame their homophobia, racism, transphobia, what have you, as an assertion of the natural order of things, that people who are gay, people who think that racial equality should be a thing or whatever, are committing an assertion against the natural order. And what shocks me about that is conservatism is, in and of itself, an assertion against the concept of social development, which is a fight against the natural order. You're trying to put toothpaste back in a tube. You don't make people stop being gay by not talking about it. I mean, what do you honestly think that this hasn't always been a thing? And maybe that's the disconnect. Maybe there are people who actually believe, and I understand, we've discussed several of them on this show, several of them this week, as a matter of fact, that there are a lot of people throughout American history whose agenda has been manufacturing this idea that America used to be a traditional white Christian nation that never really existed. And I think there's a lot of people who don't understand that was never the case. All you find when you go back through history, all the way back to the establishment of the fucking Constitution, was angry white men trying to get this country back to a period where it was a traditional white Christian nation, even before it was a nation. So this isn't a new thing, and that never happened. So there's a lot of people who think that they can fight and take back the country for a set of values that were manufactured at their root by tobacco companies, in a lot of cases, if we're being completely honest with each other. And they have this idea that they will win a war for traditional American values and save the children from the insidious gay agenda to Trojan horse communism into public schools through gay sex somehow. And I wonder how much of this they've actually thought up out loud, because when you start to try to rationalize it, it makes absolutely no objective fucking sense whatsoever. And also, just, you can't get rid of a thing once it exists. I think that we all lose sight of that a lot of the time, is that once an idea is out there, you never fully suppress that idea. Most of the ideas that exist now exist in reaction to some group trying to suppress the root of them at some point over the last 400 years. Paganism is a reaction to the church trying to suppress what a lot of dumb white Europeans thought was old-timey religion from their ancestors that weren't actually their ancestors. You know, there's the entire concept of magic is some form or fashion a version of this. There are tons and tons and tons tons of fucking examples of people who have developed ardent belief systems based in reaction to the idea that you can get rid of who and what they are, and it never works. But there is a segment of the country, roughly about a third, who cannot be convinced of this no matter what the fuck you tell them. And I don't know what to do about that besides say it louder and more frequently and maybe with guns. I really don't know, but holy fucking shit, all of this has happened 1,000 times. After the successful passing of the Don't Say Gay bill, Indiana and Kansas stand poised to adopt similar legislation. So does Tennessee. Kansas's HB 2662 establishes a parent's bill of rights and an academic transparency act requiring school districts to establish parent transparency portals to provide information on materials that are used or made available in schools, and making it a misdemeanor for any teacher who uses materials depicting homosexuality in any way. Indiana HB 1040 would prohibit any discussion of sexual orientation, transgenderism, or gender identity in any way, in any context, without parental consent. Support for gender-affirming pediatric care this year resulted in a campaign of harassment and violence against Boston Children's Hospital. In August, BCH became the first pediatric and adolescent transgender health program in the United States. Coverage suggesting that the hospital was engaging in the forced genital mutilation of children launched a conservative outrage campaign of everything from angry emails to assaulted employees to bomb threats. The outrage was largely fueled by libs of TikTok, which is a Twitter account with 1.3 million followers, known for spreading anti-LGBTQIA+ content. The page shared a video of a doctor discussing hysterectomies with the caption, quote, "Boston Children's Hospital is now offering gender-affirming hysterectomies for young girls," end quote. The narrative, from there, writes itself, as they say. As I mentioned earlier, the United States has experienced a resurgence in hate groups, and also in domestic terrorism, and probably at the forefront of recruitment has been the Proud Boys, a self-described Western chauvinist group founded in 2016. Chauvinism is defined as an unreasonable belief in the superiority or dominance of one's own group or people, who are seen as strong and virtuous, while others are considered weak and unworthy and inferior. As the legend goes, a French soldier named Nicholas Chauvin was badly wounded in the Napoleonic Wars and received a meager pension after the wars despite his injuries. After the abdication of Napoleon, Chauvin remained a fanatical believer in Bonapartism and the mission of Imperial France, despite the unpopularity of the view at the time. Chauvin's single-minded devotion, despite neglect from his own faction and harassment from detractors, came to be known as chauvinism. The English language parallel for this would be jingoism, or just dumbassery. In the case of the Proud Boys, in much the same way that paleoconservative is a metaism for old right, Western chauvinism just means white patriarchy. These are our brown shirts, for the record, or at least a facsimile thereof. They actually wear polo shirts, but what the fuck ever. The Proud Boys began in the forums of the online far-right magazine Takis, which is run by a Greek paleoconservative socialite named Taki Theodorakopoulos. It's also edited by his daughter, Mandalina, but it used to be edited by Richard Spencer. Takis launched in 2007, and it really served as a launch pad and a distribution center for Jared Taylor, Richard Spencer, and Gavin McInnes, and it helped form the nucleus of the alt-right leading up to the Unite the Right rally. In 2013, Takis drew international criticism for its support of the Greek Golden Dawn, which is a political party that's avowedly neo-Nazi. Gavin McInnes first announced the establishment of the Proud Boys on Takis in 2016. McInnes co-founded Vice Magazine with Shane Smith and Sarush Alvi in 1994 under the name The Voice of Montreal. The name was changed to Vice in 1996 and then sold to Richard Zielinski in 1998. McInnes was styled as the godfather of hipsterism, and he contributed articles like The Vice Guide to Picking Up Chicks and co-authored the book The Vice Guide to Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. Seems like a sweet fucking dude. Going back as far as 2002, McInnes expressed that he liked that hipsterism was identified as being predominantly white. And in 2003, his political views were described by the New York Times as white supremacist. He left Vice in 2008 due to what he described as creative differences. And from 2008 going forward, McInnes began making a name for himself as a right-wing political figure. He created StreetCarnage.com and founded the advertising agency Rooster, where he served as the creative director. He had a brief stint of unproduced projects with Adult Swim, presumably predicated by a long-time relationship that I don't think a lot of people are aware of with comedian David Cross. McInnes is an aggressively unfunny failed comedian and the mastermind behind comedy specials like The Brotherhood of the Traveling Rants and How to Be a Man. You know, it's funny how Dave Cross has been accused of racism throughout his career, and his argument is just, well, I was being ironic. But in reality, he's friends with an avowed white nationalist, but I'm sure that that's probably just a coincidence. He is, after all, ethnically Jewish, a thing that he makes fun of himself on a fairly regular basis. But I'm sure that also is just Dave being ironic. Whatever. This is why the identity politics conversation is so fucking stupid, in my opinion, because on the left, we have conversations about how, like, for example, Ben Shapiro can't espouse neo-Nazi ideology ever because he's Jewish, or, you know, this and that and the other thing. And meanwhile, you've got people like Alexander, who is Arabic and black, who does the Sieg Heil because he thinks it's funny and has said Black Lives Matter flags on fire. But oh no, the man could never be anti-black because he is black. That's not a thing that exists. Like, Candace Owens hasn't just been walking around getting paid for being anti-black for how many fucking years now? And Milo Yiannopoulos isn't a thing. As if there isn't an entire cottage industry on the right based around being a self-hating member of a marginalized group. I don't understand why we act like we don't know that this is a thing, but it's totally a fucking thing. I mean, we're talking about Gavin McInnes, the patron saint of metrosexuality who founded a terrorist organization based around how awesome it is to be a big, tough man. One of the initiation rites of which is to get punched in the stomach a whole bunch of times by a bunch of wannabe frat boys in tactical gear while you yell the names of 90s cartoons and ice cream and shit. Like, this is the least heteronormative thing humanly imaginable, created by a guy who quaffs his own fucking mustache. That's all I'm saying. In 2014, Gavin McInnes was ousted from Rooster after publishing an online essay titled Transphobia is Perfectly Natural. And after that, he began hosting a podcast on Anthea Cumia's Compound Media. I hesitated on even bringing that up because saying the name Anthony Cumia kind of makes me want to start foaming at the fucking mouth. There's an aspect of right-wing comedy that is so aggressively, dispassionately fucking unfunny that I find it infuriating. And I have hated Anthony Cumia for as long as I can remember. But I don't want to get tied up in that because this episode will end up being really, really, really long if I start outlining all of the reasons that being openly conservative and trying to be funny never works.
Comedy has to have a target. It's all about making fun of people to normalize things.
When has that ever worked? What are we even doing here? Why are you still giving Dave Chappelle money and a microphone for fuck? Anyway, so the Proud Boys... I'm going to get back to it. I am. I promise. I'm going to get back to it. The Proud Boys are a neo-fascist, men's-only, men's rights group that takes its name from a song that was cut from Disney's Aladdin. So, for those of you who are keeping score, the godfather of hipsterism started a men's rights terrorist organization based on the name of a song cut from a Disney cartoon. Are you still with me? Does this all sound hyper-masculine to you yet? And can we be honest with each other and say that is there anything more distinctly 21st century America than one of the organizations that is probably going to be instrumental in the successful overthrow of democracy in the United States was founded by a Canadian wannabe outdoorsman with a gigantic fake hipster beard who built an organization based on the advancement of white male superiority named after a song from a Disney cartoon. Jesus fucking Christ. After failing as a comedian and further proving and providing more evidence that there is nothing in the world more dangerous than an entitled white man who gets told that he's not good at something. Probably the best evidence of Gavin's bruised ego from the combination of all of his failures in the entertainment industry is the Proud Boys itself. At first, the group was basically just focused around an admiration for McGinnis and his ideas, primarily the hipster racism, which would come to define the alt-right, actually. McGinnis portrays white men and white culture as being under attack, and the group is a strong disseminator of white genocide theory. As such, the Proud Boys are extremely trans and homophobic, and they occupy what's known as the alt-light space of the new right, which is characterized by adherence to white nationalism and or white supremacy. The lines of demarcation became clearer following the Unite the Right rally, which really presented a schism and a tipping point for the American conservative movement, in which the fringe and the moderates kind of switched places, culminating perhaps in the January 6th riot. And even though McGinnis is technically no longer affiliated with the group, and after January 6th, most of their big brass was arrested, including Joe Biggs, who used to work for InfoWars, and Henry Tarrio, who it was brought out was both a local and federal informant the entire time he was in the group, recruitment exploded after January 6th, and they've sort of surpassed every other right-wing insurgency group in terms of number of chapters and enlistment in the last year or so. And in the last few months, the number of domestic terrorist attacks aimed specifically at queer people has kind of exploded, if we're being completely honest. The Colorado Club Q nightclub shooting comes to mind. For some background on that, Club Q used to be the only LGBTQ plus club in Colorado Springs, Colorado, which is the state's second most populous city, with a population of just over 500,000 people. A 2021 article by Denver-based magazine 5280 noted that the club was a place where LGBTQ folks went for drag performances, dance parties, and drinks. And the shooting occurred almost definitely intentionally on the eve of the Transgender Day of Remembrance. Since 2019, Colorado has had a red flag law that allows citizens or law enforcement to petition a court to order the removal of firearms from a potentially dangerous person. Of the 19 states and the District of Columbia with red flag laws, Colorado has among the lowest per capita rates of invocation of the law. In opposition to the Colorado statute, more than half of the state's 64 counties declared themselves Second Amendment sanctuaries, including El Paso County, which is where the shooting occurred. Prior to the Colorado Springs nightclub shooting, Colorado and Colorado Springs in particular experienced multiple mass shootings. The Colorado Springs nightclub shooting was actually just part of a trend of increasing frequency of mass shootings in the area. And more than half of the mass shootings in Colorado between 2013 and the event of the Colorado Springs nightclub shooting occurred in the 3 years prior to the shooting. By the time of the shooting, 2022 was the worst year for mass shootings in Colorado of the previous decade. Now, according to the police chief, the shooting began when the shooter entered Club Q while a dance party was being held. He was carrying an AR-15 and multiple magazines of ammunition and wearing body armor. The shooter began immediately shooting at people while moving further into the building. Many survivors at first mistook the gunfire for being a part of the music until the gunfire continued and patrons started to see the muzzle flashing. Multiple people sheltered behind the bar and in dressing rooms while others stayed low to the ground. Minutes into the shooting, a club patron identified as U.S. Army veteran Richard M. Fierro charged across the room and tackled the shooter to the ground, causing the rifle to fall out of reach. Fierro then grabbed a handgun from the shooter's hand and used it to hit the shooter repeatedly in the head. Fierro was assisted by other patrons, including Thomas James, who moved the rifle away to safety, and a trans woman who used her high heel to stomp on the shooter and who helped disable and hold the shooter down until the authorities arrived. Fierro estimated the shooter's weight at about 300 pounds. Police received an initial call for service regarding the shooting at 11:56 p.m. on November 19th, with the first officer being dispatched 1 minute later. The first responding officer arrived in the area at midnight and arrested a suspect 2 minutes later. A total of 39 patrol officers from all four divisions of the Colorado Springs Police Department, along with 34 firefighters and 11 ambulances, responded to the scene. The suspect was in custody within 5 minutes after the first 911 call, which is actually kind of impressive. After the shooting stopped, many were at first reluctant to leave from hiding spots as they were unsure if the shooter was reloading or if he had been stopped. Fierro, who had been covered in blood, was placed in police custody in a squad car for over an hour before he was cleared of suspicion and released. The injured were transported to three hospitals, 7 to Penrose Hospital, 10 to Memorial Hospital Central, and 2 to Memorial Hospital North. Some ambulances, with most of them AMR, had to transport up to 3 patients at a time, and a few police cruisers had to transport victims as well, actually. There were 5 fatalities: Daniel Davis Aston, 28 years old, Kelly Loving, 40 years old, Ashley Poe, 35 years old, Derek Rump, 38 years old, and Raymond Green Vance, 22 years old. 25 others were injured in the shooting, of whom 19 were injured by gunfire. One of the deceased victims, Daniel Aston, was bar supervisor and a frequent performer at the club, and another fatality, Raymond Vance, was the boyfriend of Fierro's daughter. 2 of the victims were transgender, so the spokesperson for GLAAD reached out to the Colorado Springs Police Department ahead of its planned news conference on the victims, and the organization was assured that respectful language would be used. During the press conference, the chief of the Colorado Springs Police Department made a point to say that the department respected all community members and that they would be identifying the deceased by the names that they and their loved ones used. He then read the names of the deceased victims and included their pronouns. A vigil was held on November 20th with standing room only at the All Souls Unitarian Church, which was also attended by several members of the city council. Additional memorials and events were held throughout the week, which promoted spaces for people to gather and donate. Donation drives were set up shortly after the shooting from both local organizations and GoFundMe fundraisers for the victims and their families. On November 24th, Colorado Springs Evangelical Ministry Focus on the Family was targeted with a graffiti message reading, "Their blood is on your hands, 5 lives taken." Focus on the Family can go fuck off and all, and so can James Dobson. They advocate for conversion therapy and for people to leave homosexuality and follow Christ. And I believe that a lot of people think that that sort of rhetoric may or may not have contributed to this happening in the first place. There's also been a significant ramp up in threats of violence at drag story hour events in places like Ohio and Texas. And of course, there's the allegations that threats related to Drag Story Hour had something to do with the attack in North Carolina and the subsequent 2 attacks that happened in Oregon and Washington over the last 3 days. To give you a brief overview of that, I'm going to read from a CBS article titled, "Other States Are Reporting Power Outage Attacks Similar to North Carolina, Moore County," written 2 days ago by Kayla Morton. Quote, "It looks like Moore County in North Carolina is not alone. Each day, CBS 17 is learning more and more about the incident in which 45,000 customers lost power after gunfire attacks hit different Moore County electrical substations, knocking out power through Carthage, Southern Pines, Pinehurst, and Aberdeen. Tuesday night, CBS 17 learned North Carolina isn't the only state to see intentional attacks against critical infrastructure. News Station, one of CBS 17's partners under its parent company, Nexstar, that's surprisingly transparent, really, obtained a recent federal law enforcement memo describing similar situations across the country. The memo specifically names Oregon and Washington as experiencing, quote, physical attacks on substations using hand tools, arson, firearms, and metal chains, possibly in response to an online call for attacks on critical infrastructure, end quote. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper called Saturday night's outage a criminal attack. Moore County Sheriff Ronnie Fields agreed, saying, quote, the individual that did the damage knew exactly what they were doing to cause the damage and cause the outage that they did, end quote. The federal memo also said, quote, in recent attacks, criminal actors bypassed security fences by cutting the fence links, lighting nearby fires, shooting equipment from a distance, or throwing objects over the fence and onto equipment, end quote. The targeted attack has Homeland Security experts not ruling the actions out as domestic terrorism. The attack also came just a few days after the U.S. Department of Homeland Security issued a bulletin to law enforcement noting that, quote, the United States remains in a heightened threat environment, end quote. The memo obtained by News Nation further said, quote, it's to cause widespread power failures with the potential impact of social disruption and violent anti-government activity, end quote. Now, to further bolster this point, I'm going to read from another article that I have to thank one of my listeners, Harmony, for. Thanks, hon. From Utility Dive, that actually came out in January of this year. January 26th, to be exact. Written by Robert Walton. The article is entitled, Extremists Have Developed Credible, Specific Plans to Attack the U.S. Power Grid, DHS says in new warning. The brief. Domestic terrorists have developed credible specific plans to attack the U.S. power grid and view it as a particularly attractive target given its interdependency with other infrastructure sectors, according to a security briefing issued Monday by the Department of Homeland Security. The alert warned of physical damage to electrical infrastructure, raising the specter of the 2013 sniper attack on Pacific Gas and Electric's Metcalf substation that damaged 17 transformers. The long lead time needed to replace large transformers is a threat to U.S. grid resilience, and in 2015, Congress directed the creation of a strategic reserve for critical power system equipment. Quote, Congress would be wise to revisit this program and ensure that it properly addresses the risks we face today. End quote. Mark Kerrigan, Cyber Vice President of Process Safety and Operational Technology of Cybersecurity at Hexagon PPM, said in an email. And the attack in North Carolina that's being called criminal right now has already been, at least allegedly, linked to domestic terrorism. There was a post made on Instagram, I think it was, 2 days ago, by a woman named Emily Grace Rainey. She was a soldier who participated in the January 6th insurrection. She led a group protesting a drag show in North Carolina, and she posted about the show and told her followers, quote, you know what to do. That's shortly before the attack on the power substation took place. And hours before this, she said that she knew why the power was off. So there's a terrorist who was involved in an insurrection who for some reason is just at home chilling, who is posting openly on the internet about how she knows exactly what happened and how this is part of a broader plan, obviously. And we're just going to let that go, I guess, because, you know, we have no evidence of anything, apparently, because, again, we don't teach critical thinking to anyone. And fuck, I think that's going to do it for me, listeners, for the day. I think I'm going to call that done. I think we've got it. I feel not better, but less like a tightly wound screw in a stripped hole. So that's gonna have to be good enough, I think. I don't know what we're supposed to do about any of this shit, if I'm being completely honest with you. Like, I think that everybody who is not a cis white male needs to buy and figure out how to use a gun. I think that community watches need to be formed. I think that we all need to form some sort of a community buddy system so that people aren't out by themselves, because the pigs are not going to help you in these situations. We don't know if they're not involved with the groups that are doing this stuff sometimes. So I think that the best I can tell you is try to keep each other safe. Keep each other, keep in contact with people, and learn the signs for these groups and things and how to identify them, so that if you see them in public, you know to keep an eye out for you know, problems to take place. I got nothing really. This one took a lot out of me. You know, as a non-binary person, as like a non-gender conforming person, as someone who's, you know, even before my gender identity was completely clear to me, a big exodus for me is as far as my social activism and figuring out who I was as a person separate from my sexual identity was the group of gay friends that I had in college. I was part of the Gay Straight Alliance in college, and living with and being friends with that group of guys really taught me a lot about being comfortable with myself and being okay with being who I was, despite the fact that some of the things that I liked or some of the things that I wanted to be or some of the ways that I might have wanted to dress were non-conventional and not necessarily socially acceptable at the time. So I owe a lot, separate from being a member of the queer community at this point, because I don't know what you'd call whatever I am, but it ain't straight, that's for fuck's sure. So I personally, before understanding my place within the queer community, which I'm still trying to figure out to some extent, but I owe a lot in terms of coming to understand myself, coming to have confidence in myself and my ability to do a lot of the things that I've done, to learning from the confidence of, you know, strong gay people. And in that, I think that I owe a part of my ability to become who I am today to being able to see people who were, you know, back then gay marriage was still not legal. We were trying to organize safe proms because, you know, kids who were part of same-sex couples couldn't take their partner to prom back then. There was a lot of, you know, gay rights issues are still fairly ongoing, but it was even worse back then. So it was seeing these people who were in terms of like recognition under the law, second class citizens, still be proud about who they were to the point of proclaiming it, was inspirational to me in a way. So I think that whenever I see an atmosphere evolving to where a lot of my queer friends are afraid to go out alone, I feel like something needs done, and I know that the people who are supposed to do it aren't going to do it. So after I get done with this, I'm gonna go do that. I'm gonna quit talking for now. We'll be back though. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. I can't tell you for sure if it's going to be Friday or Saturday because it's going to depend heavily on whether I'm still in North Carolina on Friday or Saturday. But it'll be this week, one way or the other. We'll be back, and we're going to have a conversation, I think, think we're going to do the vaccine thing, the anti-vax episode. I think that's what'll be next, unless, you know, something else blows up or something else happens. And I feel like we need to have another conversation about how everybody should probably read the Turner Diaries and buy a gun. But until then, I did it wrong again. God damn it. I thought we were over this. Mox, baby, Bubala, I thought we had figured this out. Didn't we get to the point where we were doing the intro correctly? God damn it. Anyway, concentrate on the HEP, everybody. And I don't know, maybe I'll drink less coffee. In the meantime, I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See. And I will catch all of you beautiful people on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it.
Finished.